from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Physician Victoria Sweet's new memoir, God's Hotel, is about her experience working at the unique Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, which cares for hundreds of elderly and disabled adults. Dr. Sweet has been working at the hospital for more than 20 years, and her book describes not only her experience with the patients, but expounds on the practice of slow medicine, which gives doctors that most precious commodity, often missing in today's healthcare system, time. She'll join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Dr. Victoria Sweet joins us in studio for this forum hour, an internist who has been a physician for over 20 years at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital. She's the author of a book about her work there and about her scholarly study of a form of pre-modern medicine from the 12th century, which we'll also talk with her about. She's an associate clinical professor of medicine at UC San Francisco, also has a PhD in history and social medicine. And her book is called God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. And she joins us for this hour. And welcome. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here and to have read you and to talk about Laguna Hospital, which is Laguna Honda Hospital, which is really in some ways one of those unique hospitals that some would say sadly are kind of going into the the way of the warrior, as we used to say, or something along those lines. I mean, this is a hospital that serves, 1,200 patients and takes many of those patients that nobody else will take, kind of end-of-the-line patients, like the old almshouse that it was.
Well, that's exactly right, Michael. It is a hospital that is probably the last of its kind, or was the last of its kind, during the 20 years I've been there. It originally started out as the San Francisco almshouse in 1860s, and in some ways has been the almshouse ever since.
And I read your piece in the Daily Beast where you say maybe we need more of these kind of county almshouse hospitals. Hmm?
Well, it serves a purpose. I mean, we're very lucky in San Francisco because this old system, the original old system for taking care of the sick poor before there was health insurance, was to have a free county hospital for the acutely ill. Anybody could come, and sometimes the rich came, sit on a bench, take a number, and wait. And then there was the free county almshouse for everyone else. So originally, the almshouse took care of anybody who had no place else to send. So, for instance, orphans, the insane, the unemployed, the homeless, and the chronically ill, the rehabilitation patient, anybody who didn't know what else to do, you sent to the almshouse, and in our case, to Laguna Honda. So it was a very useful system to have. Because you always had someplace to send people. And starting about 50 years ago, that form, especially of the almshouse, went out of fashion. In fact, about 100 years ago, we started sending the insane to insane asylums, sending the orphans to an orphan asylum, and trying to narrow the purview of the almshouse down to just the chronically ill or those in need of rehabilitation. Then, about 50 years ago, even that fell out of fashion, and most cities and counties in the country closed their almshouse very gradually until, as far as I know, Laguna Honda is probably the last or certainly one of the last places that essentially serves that almshouse function.
Yeah, when my mother used to say, you know, we'll wind up in the poorhouse, she was talking about kind of hospitals.
Over the hill to the poorhouse.
You have to be of a certain age, I think, to realize, but this is one of the last almshouses in America, and I was struck by early on in the book, you talk about Dr. Major, who is I like the name Dr. Major and Dr. Sweet. I mean, it almost sounds like an allegory or something, but how he said that there's really nothing quite like this. In fact, let me look at what he said to you when you came there. He said it was a way of taking care of those who couldn't take care of themselves. And that's something that modern medicine has pretty much eclipsed or we don't have that. In fact, I believe I was talking about the article you wrote in the Daily Beast. You were saying that you read through all of those 900-some pages.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, well,
I figured somebody had to.
Congratulations. I'm sure the president and many others who have been working for it, including maybe Congresswoman Pelosi, didn't do what you did. But I don't know that for sure. But you say that maybe you're ambivalent about health care, but also ambivalent because these are the people who don't necessarily get into the net. There's too many. For example, I think in your article you use somebody named Mrs. Ross. Mm-hmm. She's got all these different conditions. And so there's like a little compartmentalized part for all those conditions. It becomes very confusing.
That's right. Well, GA, you've picked up about three threads here.
See if you can sew them together for me.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, let me just start with the when you're talking about healthcare, I think you're talking about the Health Care Act.
I am.
So the ACA, you know, called by the left, the Health Care Act, and called by the right, Obamacare. And I'm kind of in the middle, so I don't know what to call it. I did read it, and it was a good thing to read. It was easier than I thought it was going to be to read, I think partly because I do understand healthcare, so that part was easy. It's 902 pages with 100 pages of very confusing attempts to reconcile the law that the Senate passed and the law that the House passed. But the upshot of reading it was that I felt like I liked about half of what was in it, and I couldn't stand the other half. And I think it sort of made it clear why every time they take a poll, half of America's for it and half of America's against it. Because really, half of it's great and half of it's not so great.
Right, now there are more Americans opposed to it.
Yeah, it keeps fluctuating, really. So it's hard to – depends on how you ask the question. But it gets into Mrs. Ross because really what I think's wrong with the half that I don't like about it is not any of the individual sentences or sections. But when you put the whole thing together, you end up with the most – just a nightmare of potential laws, regulations, protocols, divisions, departments, new councils. It's really terrible.
It's a bureaucratic nightmare, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. It's really scary. So if you pick out one thread, I think, oh, that's not too bad. Trailers for clinics, that's good. I've worked in a clinic before. It'd be good to have a trailer for a clinic. But when you get to a law that actually mandates what the trailer's going to look like and how many trailers are going to be, and it's a little insuperable. So I compared it to a patient. I compared our healthcare system as it is now to a patient of mine, Mrs. Ross, in the sense of this. Mrs. Ross was a very old woman. She had tons wrong with her. But the bottom line is she was still walking and talking and eating and living. In fact, she was at Laguna Honda. She was pretty demented, but every time I saw her, we'd have a nice chat, and she'd ask me how I was. And then she fell and broke her hip, as sometimes happens. She got sent to the acute care hospital, and she got the hip fixed. Wonderful modern medical care. She was up and fixed and back at Laguna Honda in 3 days. It was really a miracle. Except when I went out to see her, she was no longer walking and talking. She was comatose. Turned out that some overenthusiastic intern at the acute hospital had followed all the protocols and put her on a high blood pressure medicine and a cholesterol-lowering medicine and a reflux medicine and a pre-diabetes medicine, so many medicines that Mrs. Ross was now comatose. It took me quite a while to gradually take her off her medicine and get her walking again. And what I worry about with the Health Care Act is that we're doing the same thing to our health care system, which may not be perfect, but still fundamentally functioning in the sense that if you're sick, you get treatment, even if you don't have health insurance. It may bankrupt you, and that is a big problem. But the actual medical part of the medical care system works at least as well as Mrs. Ross worked.
Well, it gets right to the heart of a couple things, what you just said. One is how, I really like this about your book, how you give us profiles of these patients, you make them human, you give us their background and not only the things that are diagnosed in them, but also there's a kind of polemic in your book, and there is in this article too, about the necessity for time and slow medicine to sort through, for example, what the side effects can be from different medicines, and maybe somebody can be on too many medicines, but also the idea that patients deserve more time, simply deserve more time, and doctors nowadays, especially in assembly line medicine, and all the quickness and all the forms that have to be filled out, just move things along much too quickly. You had a hospital there at Laguna Honda where you had nurses who were knitting. where people really took the time with the patients, which It's extraordinary in today's world.
It is. It is. We had the time. And you know, patients deserve the time. But let me tell you, doctors deserve the time.
It's better
nurses
medicine,
too. Deserve the time. But we like doing a good job. And we can't do a good job right now when we don't have enough time. So I coined the term slow medicine as a way to sort of think about what I learned at Laguna Honda, at least a piece of what I learned at Laguna Honda.
You're right in the vanguard, though. You got slow food, slow sex.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I didn't know about slow sex.
Yeah, it's a whole book about it. But anyway.
Oh, perfect. Well, there you go. I've been comparing it to slow food, but I might have to read the book on slow sex and I'll change it. It certainly will get people's attention. But yes, like slow food. And I think we need to give credit to fast medicine. I don't want anybody to get the idea that what we have now is not absolutely superb. I mean, if you just go back 100 years ago, the difference you just can't imagine. We take for so granted what fast medicine, let's call it, does for us. And we don't even think about having pain in our surgeries. Just the basics. But over the course, especially the last 20 years, this push towards efficiency has taken the time away from doctors to do a good job. And that's what I think, simply said, needs to be put back into medicine.
Just inefficiency is more efficient than efficiency. That's the conclusion you
that
come
is
to.
The conclusion, yeah. I come to. Inefficiency in the sense of give me enough time, and I can put it very simply, is that if I get a new patient, it might take me 2 hours to work up that patient. But actually, I'm pretty cheap. That's like a couple hundred dollars it costs, okay? One MRI scan costs $1,200. So if my two-hour workup can save the patient from having an MRI scan and the system from paying for an MRI scan, my 2 hours with a patient is way more efficient, even from a healthcare economist's point of view, much less from the patient's point of view, where we might get the right diagnoses, take him or her off medications they don't need, figure out which medications they do need, have them back in a week for another leisurely half an hour exam. I mean, this is pretty simple. It's not simple. It's not complicated.
Talking with Dr. Victoria Sweet, who is Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at UCSF and also physician at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital. She'll be at the Booksmith in San Francisco, 7:30 p.m. this evening. And she's the author of a new book called God's Hotel. You were talking about medicine 100 years ago and how far we've come, but actually you go back to the 12th century.
I do, and we've really come far from the 12th century.
But you also discovered something there that's really quite meaningful, not only to you personally as a physician, but also to just the whole idea of the practice of medicine. Hildegard and a Benedictine nun, tell us about her and what drew you to her.
Well, that's actually how I got to Laguna Honda in the first place, because I'd been a doc for about 7-8 years, and I was very impressed with modern medicine and very impressed with the scientific method. But now and then I ran into things that didn't fit it. And I started exploring it. And I looked at Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, the alternative kind of medicines, homeopathy. And one day in the library, Hildegard's book on medicine just basically fell out of the shelves, literally, on the floor. I picked it up, pretty much, and started reading her medicine. And I was very surprised. She was a 12th century nun, a visionary mystic, and many of your listeners will know her because of her remarkable music. But it turned out she was also a medical practitioner, and she'd written a medical book on her practice, and it had been recently translated from the Latin into German into English. And that's the book that really kind of changed what I do with myself. Because what I found was her medicine was not the eye of newt, toe of frog kind of medicine that I had thought it would be. It was a real medicine for real patients with real diseases that I could recognize. But her way of looking at those diseases and her patients was completely different from mine. And that's why I decided to go back and get a PhD, because I wanted to study Hildegard and understand.
You even learned Latin, didn't you?
I did learn Latin.
Yeah. I mean, that's very ambitious. That's almost as ambitious as reading the whole healthcare report, but a proposal. But there's something about her work that's really very striking in that she, I guess, looks at the body as like a garden and mm-hmm. the physician or the healer as a gardener.
That's basically what I learned. reading her books and her book and other medical writers of the same era, that the pre-modern medicine thought very differently about the body from we do. We fundamentally think about the body as a machine and the doctor as a mechanic. And the questions I ask when I'm in that model is, what's wrong? What can I do to fix it? Now, this is a very useful model for people who are acutely ill. If somebody's had been in a car accident, has appendicitis, a heart attack, cancer, modern medicine and that way of looking at things is great. But when they're chronically ill or after the heart attack or the appendectomy or the car accident or the chemotherapy, that model doesn't work as well. And Hildegard's model, which looked at the body more like a plant really than a garden, and the doctor as a gardener more like a mechanic, is much more useful. What's the difference? The fundamental difference is that someone has to fix a broken machine, but a plant can heal itself. And Hildegard called the power of a plant to heal itself its greening power, and in Latin, viriditas, from viridis, which means green. And she assumed that people, patients, had their own kind of healing power, their own viriditas, and that what the doctors was supposed to do was to cultivate that innate power of healing that we all have, cultivate it, remove obstructions to it, fortify it, and nourish it with the surrounding environment. What's the surrounding environment? Good question. Good food, drink, quiet, sunlight, peace, rest.
Well, you had one patient, for example, who just said, really all I want are better glasses and better food. And
yes.
That turned out to be pretty minimal, but what she needed. And another patient you write about, Miss McCoy, you call her.
Yes.
I mean, it gets into some psychoanalytic material, but she transferred onto you, and she just wanted to please you. And mm-hmm. that was the way for her really to come out of a lot of what she was afflicted with and despair of. I mean, just wanting to please the doctor can be something enormously potentially healing. And you have all these different cases. Let's go back, in fact, to Mr. Grenz, because that's one of the first cases that you learn a lot from.
Yes.
In terms of your vision of medicine.
I should say for your audience that all of these names and some of the identifying details have been changed, as well as the names of the staff in the hospital. So for those of you who know Laguna Honda, their names aren't quite the ones you're expecting. Mr. Grenz, yes. Mr. Grenz was really quite interesting. He was one of the first patients I had, and he was a 28-year-old Polish gentleman who had taken to drink. And when I say taken, I mean taken. He drank about two quarts of vodka a day.
Drink took him.
Yeah. There you go. He ended up at the general hospital with his pancreas having been dissolved by his drink, which is very, very serious problem. He was in the ICU for weeks. He had tubes in every orifice. It was touch and go, but finally he was sent over to Laguna Honda. And I read the report before I went out to see him, and I kind of knew what to expect, but when I went out to see him, I was shocked because the one thing the report hadn't told me was that Mr. Krenz had this enormous tongue. His tongue was sticking out of his mouth, and he couldn't get it back in his mouth. Not only that, but his head seemed a little big, and it was kind of dusky, and his veins of his neck were a little bit swollen. And I really couldn't figure out what it was, but it kind of nudged something in my brain, some diagnosis I'd learned in medical school. I examined him, and got a chest x-ray because our x-ray department was about to close before I'd finished completely examining him and went up to see it. And when I looked at the chest x-ray, I saw this very unusual shaped heart, which again jogged something, but I couldn't really identify it. However, one of my colleagues downstairs was very good at x-rays. So I ran down and fetched her, and she looked at it and said, "Victoria, that's a pericardial effusion." And that made me remember the diagnosis of a superior vena cava syndrome, which can happen when there's an obstruction to the veins that need to drain the blood in your upper extremities, your head, your upper part of your chest, if that gets obstructed, that can cause your head to swell, your tongue to stick out, what Mr. Grant's had. And with pericardial effusion, I wondered if it was new or old and whether that could have something to do with pericardial effusion is when fluid of some kind fills up the pericardial sac and can create pressure on the heart that's so severe that it can actually stop the heart beating. So it can be an emergency depending on how acute it was. It was hard to figure out how to determine that, but then I remembered that there was a physical diagnostic sign called pulsus paradoxicus. And that was a sign that you could find on a physical exam, which had to do with the way the blood pressure and pulse reacts to pressure in the chest. I'm not sure I should go into the details.
No, it's not important to go into all the
medical
details.
But at any rate, I went down to him, and sure enough, he had pulsus paradoxicus. That meant that this pericardial effusion, although I didn't know what it was probably the cause of his swollen face and was acute. I sent him back to the general, and 2 hours later, he had 2 quarts of blood removed from his pericardial sac.
And you learned from that something very important.
I did. I learned that the physical examination of the patient, that time to observe, to check, and to really see what it is the patient is showing you on their body is a crucial part of medicine. And the better I got at that, the better doctor I would be.
And you also talk about a patient who's schizophrenic, and you began to think that maybe there's some kind of chemical deficiency that accounts for schizophrenia.
Yes, that in some ways was, I have to confess, slightly disappointing because I'd actually gone into medicine originally because I'd fallen in love with the work of Carl Jung. And my idea was I was going to be a Jungian analyst. But at the time, you had to be a doctor to go to Jungian school. So I got to medical school. Now, I liked the work of Jung and I liked the work of Lange, who both explained the meaning of mental illness as having a meaning. It wasn't just an illness. It was actually could be profound mystical experiences. And I ended up doing a year of psychiatry after medical school. And there I began to get a suspicion that, in fact, maybe it was more like a disease than it was a mental and mystical experience. And being at Laguna Honda, there was Jimmy, who you're mentioning. But in general, being at Laguna Honda, we had a lot of schizophrenic patients particularly. And I was struck by how similar their hallucinations were. The Chinese schizophrenic, the Muslim schizophrenic, the Jewish schizophrenic, they all had similar patterns, right?
Particularly kind of paranoia. Really.
Somebody was after them. Might be the KGB, it might be the KKK, it might be the Gestapo, but all of them had very similar things. And when you treated them with medications, they got much better. And that made me wonder.
Coming up on a break, we're talking with Victoria Sweet. Her new memoir is called God's Hotel. I want to open the phone lines, invite those of you listening to join us, talk about slow medicine, talk about maybe experiences some of you may have had with your family or with yourself at Laguna Honda Hospital, and the idea of, well, a charitable type of hospital or a last stop type of hospital like an almshouse. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with physician Victoria Sweet. Her new memoir is called God's Hotel. It's about her experience working at, well, the unique Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, which cares for hundreds of elderly and disabled adults. And she's been working at the hospital for over 20 years. Her book describes not only her experience with the patients, but really expounds on the practice of slow medicine, which gives doctors that most precious commodity often missing in today's healthcare system, time. And I wanted to actually correct something I said earlier, wrong information about Dr. Sweet's availability. She's actually going to be at a launch party at that bookstore I mentioned. That is the Booksmith in San Francisco. And the time is right. It's 7:30, but the date is not right. It's this Friday, not today. So if you'd like to come to the party, I think it's open to the public, and she'd probably like you there. We're going to go to your calls and emails. And by the way, you can join us not only by phone at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, but email us, forum@kqed.org. And there are a couple of other ways to send questions and comments our way, and that is by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or to our Facebook page, and we'll bring you into this discussion in a moment or so. There's certain things that really stay in my memory after having read your memoir. One is T and D. I mean, I don't know what their real names were, but that's what they're called. And these are the efficiency experts who come in and take stock of everything and did at Laguna Honda and sort of shook things up and made things move more toward the modern. And there was a loss in that, real loss. Yeah.
There was, and it was epitomized by the what happened with nursing, actually. Because one of the strengths of Laguna Honda at the time was that it actually followed Florence Nightingale's model of hospitals. In fact, the hospital that I worked in, the old Laguna Honda, the one that's now been replaced, was set up on the Nightingale model with individual long open wards of about 30 patients and a head nurse who sat all day long at the top of that ward and could see all of her patients. This was the Nightingale plan, she said. One head nurse, one ward. Why? Because that head nurse, talk about time, could have the time and the just the visuals of seeing all the patients at once. It was actually crucial to how well the hospital worked. And D&T came in and said, this is so old-fashioned. I mean, we can save a lot of money, of which D&T would get 10% of anything they saved, but would not have to kick in anything that ended up costing more. If we just cut the nurses in half, we'll just cut the head nurses in half, we'll have one head nurse for every two wards. And we'll give her a beeper and we'll give her two cell phones and she can do two wards. And I'm telling you, Michael, it was a disaster. It was the biggest change for the worse that I'd seen, even more than anything that happened with the docs. Because once you had, it was a little bit like, reminded me what happened with the Red Queen and Alice in Wonderland, you know.
Cut off their heads?
Not cut off their heads. That's a good one. It was the one about when she told Alice that they had tea every other day. And Alice was like, great, well, can we have tea? She says, oh, no. She says, no, not today. She says, tea every other day. Tea yesterday and tea tomorrow, but never tea today. I felt like it was always the head nurse was always on the other ward. She was never on the ward you were on. She was always on her other ward. So it was a big loss. And that was the D&T. It was the biggest thing they did, I thought.
Did they get rid of the chickens going through the AIDS ward?
Oh, they did. They took the chicken away. The chicken was a wonderfully entertaining for those AIDS guys. And yes, she wasn't very hygienic, and she wasted the time of the nurses. But boy, it was worth my while just to go over to the ward and around lunchtime and watch that chicken walk down the wards and watch the AIDS patients who'd saved her little bits of food from their meal, feed her, and watch their faces light up.
Let's we got a lot of lit up calls here, so let's go to some
too.
Of them. And we begin, Ron, with you. Good morning.
Thank you. Laguna Honda is an exception. It's the first all-green hospital in California of its kind. And I've been a court-appointed volunteer conservator for mentally ill patient who's been in and out of many hospitals, military and San Francisco hospitals and out of area and in cross-country. And the finest care that this patient has had has been in Laguna Honda for 8 years. And, of course, with the new hospital and the staff and that uniqueness of that hospital itself, in the dealings with patients through the hopeandbeyondproject.org and students and service, we have never seen a finer facility for those, even with mental dysfunctions and those with fantasies and schizophrenic and paranoid aspects of their life. The medication, the support systems, not only the medication, but the staff's understanding an allowance for them to express themselves without condemning them. It is a unique facility for the care of people in the state and city of San Francisco, and it should be really recognized as a model and financially supported for those who are elderly and are that status.
Okay, Ron, we thank you for the call, and certainly dovetails with a lot of what Victoria Sweet has had to say and written about in her over 20 years at Laguna Honda. Let me go to more calls. Evangeline, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to comment on about the deplorable state of lack of eye contact, both in the medical field and mental field where I'm at the present being so-called served. The minute the doctor walks into the room, he or she sits at the computer and gives me generic answers that could be applicable to anything I might have asked. It is clearly not zeroing in on my needs or my problems.
Evangeline, I'm sorry, but your phone is making a lot of noise here. But doctors on computers too much? I mean, that's certainly a complaint one hears about modern medicine.
Oh, boy. She certainly dovetails into probably the biggest lesson that I took from my years at Laguna Honda, and that is that medicine is personal, that the practice of medicine is a personal relationship between doctor and patient. And when it's personal, it works. And I think what Evangeline is pointing out as a patient is the opposite. When it's not personal, it doesn't work very well.
Well, she mentioned eye contact, and I'm struck by that because mm-hmm. we had Eric Kandel, Nobel laureate on, also a physician, talking about how important it is, human contact mm-hmm. and the faces and the eyes and so forth. But I know you hang around at Stanford a lot. Abraham Verghese, who has been on the show a number of times and who I've done a number of events with, talks about the importance of touch in medicine.
Yes.
I mean, that again gets back to that personal human side.
It is. It's a personal relationship. You and me right now, we're having an eye-to-eye personal contact. And in a way, I think we almost create a unit by being in a certain contiguity and recognizing that contiguity, which changes. If I was in a different room, even in the same building, we wouldn't have this sort of oneness.
Or even if we were talking on the phone, and we do have a lot of guests on the phone. It's always struck me as odd that Terry Gross does all of her interviews mm-hmm. with somebody on the phone. And mm-hmm. Ted Koppel, when he did Nightline, did not want to see or make eye contact with any of
really?
The people that he interviewed. Would always be done in a remote way. A part of what an interview process is, like a doctor-patient,
that's
is
exactly
just
right.
that.
Yeah. Because the thing is, I'm talking about medicine. Medicine's personal. But one of the things I think is you can generalize my experience at Laguna Honda, and you can generalize it across this whole country. That for the last 20 years, it's gotten, for better and for worse, less personal, less one-to-one. And it's the one-to-one, the eye contact, the touching, the smelling, the being with someone that not only makes you effective and therefore efficient, it's what makes it fun. It's the whole point of it.
We'll go to more of your calls. We go to Vallejo. Mitch, welcome. You're on.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi.
Dr. Sweet, I appreciate considerably, you know, the work that you've done, and I'm very, very happy that you're being able to be on this show because mm-hmm. as an osteopathic physician and an associate professor that teaches osteopaths to become what they are, you know, we base a huge amount from day one on the essence of the philosophy of mm-hmm. striving to find the health in the patient
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just focusing on disease. Certainly the study of the disease is very important, but, you know, the essence of seeing the health is really where it happens. And, mm-hmm. you know, the manipulation aspects and the physical diagnosis are key to what we teach. And you know, the slow medicine that you call, I think, is a great, you know, a great phrase that I hope catches on. But, you know, how do we do this in a fashion that, you know, I teach students to do this, but yet when they mm-hmm. go out, you know, immediately they're brought into the, you know, the electronic medical records of which they are, mm-hmm. they're back to the patient, they're rattling away on a keyboard, and they're not listening with all their senses. But how do we do this and make it financially stable?
Well, that's all very fascinating, Mitch. Thank you for sharing the fundamental principle behind osteopathy with us. You know, I think if you just don't have enough time, you can't do it. So the only way to have doctors have this personal relationship is to give us back the time we need to do it. So then the question is, well, gee, isn't that inefficient? Isn't that costly? Well, frankly, I wish it were costly. I wish I was expensive as an MRI, but I'm not. I'm cheap. 2 hours with me, you can have 10 hours with me or one MRI. So I think what we do need to do is to prove my somewhat perhaps overstated hypothesis by creating maybe a proof of principle. It's one of the things I'm interested in doing at this point in my life once the book is sort of settled, tucked in, and that is let's experiment with this. Let's challenge healthcare economy orthodoxy.
It's already happening to some degree. We did a program, in fact, on a number of specialties that have come together and decided, you know, there has to be a real reason, a more serious, profound reason for doing, say, an MRI or something along those lines with respect to diagnostic work. Because there's a lot of tests that really are unnecessary.
Right, but the only way I know whether they're necessary or not, in my opinion, is to have enough time. If you come to me, I read those recent reports saying, you know, for certain episodes of back pain, the doctor should not order an MRI.
Right.
Well, how do I know which episode of back pain you, Michael, are having unless I have the chance?
It's Dan you want to talk about with the back pain.
Unless I have the chance to examine you thoroughly. Now, if I have a chance to examine you thoroughly, it sort of becomes pretty clear you don't need an MRI right now. But if I have the 10 minutes that I'm given, of which now 3 minutes I'm going to spend on electronic health records, there is no way I can tell whether your back pain needs the MRI or your back pain doesn't need the MRI. So guess what? I ordered the MRI.
And we're talking to Victoria Sweet. Again, her book is God's Hotel. Oliver Sacks says about it, a most important book which raises fundamental questions about the nature of medicine in our time. It should be required reading. Does he mean by everybody? I guess he does, doesn't he?
I hope so.
By the way, you can feel free to join us here. It's toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. You can also send us your questions or comments via Facebook, and we'll go to Judy next. Judy, hi, you're on.
Hi, thanks a lot. Hi, Victoria, it's Judy London here.
Hey, Judy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to hear you, and I'm so excited about what you've done. I wanted to just mention and maybe find out if this is still going on. When I worked at Laguna Honda as a psychologist, I was given the great opportunity and freedom to lead groups of patients who had Alzheimer's and actually wrote a book about it, Connecting the Dots, because I was so impressed by how much is still remains. And I wondered if that's still in the dementia units, if they're still able to provide any programming for those people with the new move that went on.
You know, Judy, I can't tell you because for the last 2 years, just pretty since a little bit before the move, I've been working on this book like about a billion hours a day. And so I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, you do have a lot of time if you've got a billion hours. Judy, thank you. Good to hear from you. We hear next from Sandra. Hi, Sandra. You're on.
Yes, this is Sandra from Berkeley.
Go ahead.
Am I on?
Yeah, you're on. Please, go ahead.
My comment is that the 12th century analogy of seeing the patient as a garden and using time and healing, natural healing, is similar to what naturopathic doctors do. One of the places they get trained is in Portland, Oregon. And if you have a chronic condition and, of course, you can afford it, you can get that kind of approach to medicine and also have more time. And that's basically my comment.
It's actually a very interesting comment because my understanding of what happened when modern medicine and the new model of body as machine came in, the model of body as a plant did in fact get sort of pushed under. I think of it as being pushed under within under our consciousness. So it's still a sort of subconscious idea we all have about another way to treat the patient. And it did also then pop up in homeopathy, naturopathy, and other alternative medicines. So it is. It did survive.
And we thank you for the call. And we'll go right to another caller. And that's you, Michael. Join us. Hi, you're on.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I wanted to know from the doctor regarding the importance of touch and her example with back pain and how to categorize it is, I know at Stanford there's a lot of work done on computerized diagnostic tools. Put in the symptoms, it'll tell you what's wrong with you. Does she think one of the critical failure points for this kind of software is how do you teach a computer how to categorize things? And if you can't teach the computer because it's too hard of an artificial intelligence problem, how you train the people using the software to appropriately categorize things to get the right diagnosis? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We thank you for the question.
Oh, that's just a brilliant question. I love that question. I've watched this for at least 20 years, and I think of it as you know, first they were going to make computers think like doctors, and it was artificial intelligence, and then they realized how difficult that was, so now they make doctors think like computers, and I call that artificial stupidity. What do I mean by that? I mean that you're exactly right, that they've worked for 20 years, and all the computer can do at this point with something like, let's say, a cough, is tell the doctor after you put in, you know, input all the information and all the physical findings, which in fact you may not or may or may not have, is something like, well, there is a 62% chance that this patient has an upper respiratory illness, a 17% chance that the patient has acute bronchitis, a 7% chance that he has sarcoid, and a 3% chance of other, which is really not useful.
In the book, you write about this character whom you alluded to before, Jimmy, and you say that of all the patients you work with, one of the cases that you regret the most just didn't.
I do.
On the other hand, we can talk about that, but on the other hand, there's a patient, for example, who comes in, she was a prostitute and a drug addict and was being abused by a boyfriend and so forth. And there's a case where, again, you get into the personal, you get into her life, and you really helped her bring about kind of a healing. She got rid of the boyfriend. I mean, did a lot of things that really, I mean, as a physician, you were almost like a physician of the soul in some ways in that case.
Boy, Michael, I wish I could take credit for that, but I really can't. I got to watch it. I got to learn from it. But I think that Terry Becker, not her real name, but that's why I call her in the book, healed herself. And watching that healing take place was what made me get to sort of really see that we really do have a natural power of healing, and that sometimes all I have to do as a doc is clear away the obstructions to, or help you clear away the obstructions to your own natural
power
of healing.
That's a very vital role, though. That's a catalyst to self-healing, as you call it.
Well, I think it's something that we can do. It's something we can do. I mean, we can't really heal somebody. You know, when they talk about healers, I have known some healers. One of the nursing assistants at Laguna Honda was a healer. I don't even know if she knows she's a healer, but I think she may. And I watched her. She would take care of a patient, and the patients would get better. It was just phenomenal to watch.
Talk about Jimmy and what you regret.
Well, what I regret about Jimmy is that Jimmy was a real schizophrenic. And in his case, he had what turned out to be kind of a common schizophrenic hallucination that he was a vending machine. So he ate coins. And he lived in the park, and he had his little place in the Golden Gate Park, and that's where he lived, and he ate coins. And one day, the bicycle patrol came and found him comatose. They took him to the general. They found out that he was very anemic, which was why he was comatose. And the reason he was anemic was because he had an excess of zinc, because our coins are no longer made with silver and copper. They're made with zinc. And because Jimmy had been eating coins, he had a zinc excess, which suppresses your copper, and you need copper to make blood. So that's why he was anemic. So they took some x-rays and found out he had $1.26 worth of change in his GI tract, and removed those coins, sent him to Laguna Honda. And when he was at Laguna Honda, he got the Laguna Honda treatment, which was basically feeding him, giving him a quiet surroundings, and also giving him medication for schizophrenia. It took a couple of months, but he stopped eating coins. He started eating food. He was my patient who gained the most weight. And after about 4 months, he looked great. He sounded great. He was filled out. He just looked like the young man he was. And he told me, well, I'm ready to leave, Doc. Thanks very much. And I said to him, Jimmy, how about, you know, we give you a little medicine, some vitamins, a little, some of the medicine that makes you stay anchored to planet Earth? And he, no, I really don't need anything, Doc. Really not. I can take care of myself. And he left. And 6 weeks later, the social work told me that he'd been found dead in the park. And that's a death I regret to this day because Jimmy, in my opinion, had schizophrenia, which is not a mental disease but a physical disease, as physical a disease as diabetes. And he needed antipsychotics, and he has the right to refuse them.
Why do you feel some sense of responsibility because he personally refused them and had the right to legally refuse? Why?
I just wasn't right. I had to. I wouldn't have let a diabetic leave with glucoses in the 600s. You know, well, that's not exactly. I mean, to be honest, let me retract that. I wouldn't have let somebody who's septic, who's delirious because of their sepsis, right,
okay,
leave, because the diabetes thing is really a very different. I'd have to give you a different scenario.
I get the analogy.
The point is that somebody who is delirious, confused, hallucinating because of a medical condition, we treat that medical condition, even if they say to us, like your children do, oh, I don't want my ear examined, don't give me that shot, right? We don't ask, you don't ask your child, and you don't ask a patient who's delirious, but we ask a schizophrenic who thinks that he's being controlled by, you know, Martians, whether he wants his antipsychotic or not, and I don't think it's proper.
We'll go to calls. Casey, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, I wondered what your guests thought about. I think we have, like, she's saying the doctors don't have enough time for all the patients, and I feel like 75% of the conditions people go to doctors for are nutritional conditions, the same way as for 100 years they described scurvy as a disease, and it was just a nutrition problem, and meanwhile those people were all trying to keep diseases from spreading, and that kind of seems like what's going on today.
You know, I love your callers, Michael. They're really smart people. It's a pleasure. Oh, yeah, you're right. And most of, you know, the newest fad disease is metabolic syndrome. What can I say? I think you're correct.
Thank the caller. And we go more calls. Deborah, hi, you're on.
Hi, Michael. And I'm just, Dr. Sweet, I want to say how much I appreciate this paradigm of practicing slow medicine. I'm a geriatric care manager, and I have been following Dr. Dennis McCullough, and I didn't know if you were familiar with him. My mother, your mother, practices slow medicine in the geriatric community. And I just want to say that I hope that more and more doctors like you, and I'm curious to know a little bit of what you're seeing as far as spreading the practice of slow medicine throughout medical school. As a geriatric care manager, one of my primary roles is an advocate for my clients so that when they do go into the hospital or when we are in the doctor's office, that I really ask the questions and my client and I really evaluate and assess procedures because, you know, is it really necessary, you know, at this point in life, you know, to have your whole, you know, everything be about another procedure and another procedure, and what kind of quality of life is this giving the client? And at what point do you start discussing, you know, what to do as far as procedures and when to, you know, when to kind of just stay the course and enjoy the rest of the life you have? And so that's my comment, and I'll take the response off the air.
Thank you.
Well, that's... Thank you very much. I really don't have too much of a comment to that, except thank you for your work.
There's a listener named Marianne who writes, I'm a utilization review case manager RN for a managed care group working on Medicare HMO patient. Mm. I find that even when physicians have personal relationships with patients, especially with specialists such as pulmonologists and oncologists, and they are managing chronic disease, they never seem to want to give up. And the patients, many of whom are in the age range 82 to 97, are still dying in the intensive care unit, suffering on ventilators with all sorts of intervention. The personal relationship seems to be what compels the physician to not tell the whole story to the family in terms of advice or recommendations on the prognosis and likely outcome.
Gee, I mean, that's a complicated It's a complicated email, I think, and it's a complicated question. I think it's rather astute. It's sort of talking about the negative side of having a personal relationship. I think what the writer is suggesting is that if I have a personal relationship with a patient, I might that might interfere with my judgment. Maybe that's partly what
you start
she's
feeling
saying.
Some attachment or personal involvement that may, in fact, compel you to say something much more positive than you should be saying. I think that's the pith of it.
I think so too, and I don't really have an answer for that. I think that's it needs to be kind of an individual. It's an individual question. We do, as physicians, we do have to manage that.
Well, a little bit of time left with Victoria Sweet. When you look at the new modern building and all at Laguna Honda, you have mixed feelings, I bet, don't you?
Well, I have to say it's really beautiful. It's just stunning.
Aesthetics notwithstanding, though. I mean,
it's got,
it also
just
stands
like
for a different type of medicine.
It does, and it's like a person, It's got the faults of its virtues.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you, and congratulations on your book, and thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you, Michael, for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
God's Hotel, a doctor, a hospital, and a pilgrimage to the heart of medicine, and the launch party will be April 27th at Booksmith, 7:30 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday at 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. In fact, you can continue this conversation about slow medicine and the like on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and also our producers, Judy Campbell, Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.